Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
It's Martin, Tristan and Joshua who are going to talk about disruption.
Hello everyone, how are you? Thanks for being here at this panel this evening. Everyone else from outside, come in, something very interesting is happening. Come in. So, I'm really happy I got asked to speak on this panel. I had a talk earlier about what I do, which I think we're going to just do a few intros here for 5 minutes and just let you guys know why we're sat on the stage and what we're up to. So, yeah, my name's Joshua Coombs. I run something called Do Something for Nothing, and it's a charity. Well, it's a movement, basically. It's people who are using a hashtag on social media to try and help out in their communities in different ways. This started with me about 3 or 4 years ago now, going out in London and cutting hair for people who are living on the street, people who are homeless. I'm sure we know what it's like, all of us, I'm looking at in this room right now, to walk past somebody on the street and wonder, what the hell can we do about it? What can each one of us do to try and interact with this in a way? Possibly we're asking questions of why that person is there. Possibly we're finding answers in our head that maybe qualify and enable us to continue walking past that person for the rest of our life. But for me, I truly believe that behind every human I see on the street, there's somebody who's of value and somebody who has as much right to all the things that I have in my life. And this began through these interactions that I had cutting hair to then tell these stories to other people. I was working in a salon at the time in South London, and this, in the short space of about 3 months, took over my life. The reason for that was a problem that I felt helpless towards became closer to me. It became something that I was interacting with in a way that I could tangibly feel was making a difference, if it just be something as small as handing someone the mirror at the end of a haircut. I saw the way people became more confident. But what really happened at the core of this was I was hearing someone's story. I was allowing enough time to listen. I used to think I was listening to my clients in the chair, and don't get me wrong, I was. They were paying enough money for it. But it was actually a kind of listening that I realized that when somebody is down and out, and you're their ears, and you can sit there and be with them and be present with them, it felt quite powerful for me, and it felt like something that was worth pursuing. So, Do Something for Nothing is, like I said, a hashtag that was posted with these stories that I put on social media. It became quickly a movement of lots of other people doing similar things. And I guess my way to kind of look at how I can disrupt the future, and in the title of this panel, is actually trying to disrupt what charity looks like. And that's not to say that anyone gets into charity or volunteering their time for the wrong reason. But it is to say that I didn't feel like it was accessible to me before. That was probably my own problem, probably because I was too lazy to fill out a form and volunteer my time in a way that someone else thought that I should. Some of the big NGOs and charities that I was looking at that helped homelessness, they didn't really do it for me. And I know that everyone gets into this for their own reason, but I'm really interested in the individual. I'm really interested in how we can all tap into our personal skills and the short time we might have to be able to help one another more in our community. So I can, as this panel goes on, give you more examples of that, talk more deeply about what it is that I do, but that's a quick intro into Do Something for Nothing.
Thank you. My name's Tristan. I'm the head of community and marketing at a company called Monzo. So before I start, maybe a show of hands for anyone who's heard of Monzo. There we go. Oh, much better. I should have asked for people who don't know Monzo.
Sorry.
Very nice. So we started Monzo about 4 years ago to provide an alternative to the banks of the past. I think this was very evident post-2008, and it felt like, from two perspectives, banks and the financial institutions were falling behind, both on technology, in a world where you can access Facebook and talk to anyone around the world instantly, or you can call a car to your door instantly. The banks suddenly were this very legacy system where every time you wanted to access them, you had to go into a branch or log onto your computer and download a statement. It felt like we'd fallen behind there. And then from an ethical point of view, it also felt like we'd fallen behind. We'd lost touch with what banks were maybe 50 or 100 years ago, where they were there to actually help you as an individual or help you for your business. And so we wanted to build something that brings those two things together, to think about how can you build a bank that uses modern technology that actually helps people with their day-to-day lives, and at the same time is also ethical and isn't building institutions that end up in financial crises like we saw 10 years ago. And that's where Monzo came from. And so it's a banking app on your smartphone. The only way you access it is through your smartphone. And hopefully we enable you to understand your money better so that you're not just looking at that statement at the end of every month with a sort of cold flannel on your head and crying silently to yourself. But instead, it's with you every single day. It's enabling you to understand where your money's going, to help you to send money to friends and budget better, and also helping you to understand money and the financial institutions better. What we see over and over again now is people coming out of school and university and suddenly being asked to do these very, very grown-up things and having no understanding of how to do it. How do you rent your first house or even get a mortgage if you're that lucky? And it feels like we have an opportunity to help people there, to help them understand how money works in practice and not just in theory. So today we're a company, we have over 1,000 employees, just nearly 3 million customers with this hot coral pink card that Joshua showed off. And hot coral, that's its branded name. Like pink.
Okay, all right.
And also starting to push out into thinking about financial inclusion and working out how do we help people get onto the almost the ladder, right? So banks act as this gatekeeper to society in some ways. For anyone who's moved to the UK from abroad, you'll know that it's almost impossible to get a bank account. Even if you have moved from France with a job already, you need this triumvirate of a council tax bill that you can't get until you've got your rental agreement, and you can't get a rental agreement until you've got a bank account, and you can't pay your council tax until you've got a bank account. You go round and round. And that's if you've come from France with a job. And so if you're an asylum seeker or you're homeless, it's almost impossible. And that's something, as a bank, that we're really well placed to solve. And that's part of the journey that we're on.
Okay, thank you. Now, these speakers are strictly in age order. Got that? These are brilliant young men, okay? So, why is Next Meal invited? I live in an area of Muswell Hill. It's in North London. And somebody 25 years ago decided to have a little soup kitchen thing where they fed people five nights a week. And about 12 years ago, somebody came to the door and gave me a key to this place and said, I've had enough, you know, it's at the top of the road, see you later. So, okay, that happened. And as I say, with the first speaker, we got to know people. It's a very, very good thing to engage with people, particularly homeless people. And then last year we thought, can we do things a little differently? Some of you perhaps are from Birmingham, am I right? Something happened in Birmingham that really forced me to think about doing something. A lady came shopping in Birmingham, lived in Stourbridge, and she saw a homeless person. She felt sorry for that homeless person and took him to her home in Stourbridge and supported them, tried to help them. A year later, most unfortunately, she was murdered by this person and the son too. Her husband at the trial said that I wish my wife had never seen that person ever. So I'm a lecturer in housing and economics, and I looked at that and I thought, can we do something? Can we create something that might help to reduce the amount of people perhaps on the street and inform people? So we created something called Next Meal, which is a web page for smartphones. All we did was track all the soup kitchens, the provision for homeless people across the UK and parts of Europe. That's all we did. And we, so wherever you are, 24/7, just click on it. You'll see the nearest place for food and support, Next Meal. In consequence, we then wrote to, you know, we're in contact with the 400 centres. We then write to them, we create a digital magazine. And suddenly we've joined everyone up, from here to Milan, Birmingham, the rest of it. But the most important thing is that we look at, say, in France, that you see a homeless person. The person may ask you for money, but you have to be able to know, you'll be informed right there and then, where is the support right now for that person? Because ultimately, the best place to be if you are in acute need is to go to these centres and have received the help of the expert. So that was Next Meal and how it's sort of taken off. And the objective is just to be in every city of the world. That's all. But we've just done 12 months and we're very privileged to be here tonight. So it's questions now, isn't it? So ask the young men question because they're very clever.
Thank you. I want to just follow up and say that I feel really... I feel like there's an interesting discussion to be had based on the different voices that were up here, and I think that's, for me, been the theme of being here at Greenbelt so far, is actually trying to have a conversation with people from different areas and doing different things. I'm very happy if we open to questions now, but I just wanted to touch on a couple of points that I heard. And I think, starting with Monzo and what you're doing, I think the way that you mentioned homelessness, and for instance, if someone's an asylum seeker, these things are as real as they get, and it's solving a very tangible problem. I don't know where all of you guys live, but where I live in Southeast London in Peckham, I see the queues at the banks in the morning when there's that 2-hour walk-in window when people can open an account. I see the faces turned away all the time. These are the things that I know are so far removed for some of us, but are literally life-crucial moments where people are through this, as you said, this web of what's available and what's not. So I think it's really important. And equally, I'm very happy to be on stage. And I think linking up something like Next Meal to like different places we're trying to help out are great. I don't know whether it's a good, because we were supposed to have maybe a mediator for this possibly, but to open up immediately to questions, we've got a good half an hour or so. So, in fact, longer.
Hi, my name's Anne. In half of my life, I'm an activist, and in half of my life, I'm a sociologist. I was really, really interested at the social movement as a hashtag thing, because as soon as other people jump on using the hashtag, you've lost any control over the direction that the hashtag goes. And I was just wondering how that made you feel.
Thanks, Anne. That's a really interesting question. Thank you very much. You're right. You lose. There's no control. What I do, there's an open space for other people to take it as they will. Luckily, for me, this is something that I was never in control of, nor will I ever be in control of anyway, which is just the human connections that we can all create and make with one another each day. If you look at the hashtag, Do Something for Nothing, I'd love if you guys get involved and, you know, kind of see what's on there. There's people who are doing different things, whether that's yoga teachers going into rehabilitation centers, whether that's people having a meal with someone who's elderly and doesn't have any family and coming and see them. There's also the odd selfie in a not very kind of, I guess, in a way that is maybe like a tag for tag thing where people are just trying to get some likes. And there's also things that make no sense whatsoever, but the majority, it's been well established, I think, because when I started, it was about 10 posts that were already on the hashtag. So it was basically an unused portal that sat there on Instagram. And now there's nearly 30,000. And the majority is people doing so much good that those few in between, I'm very willing to take. I think it's a really good question because, look, social media, is it okay to... For me, for instance, I had to ask myself a very big question at the beginning that I'm going and seeing somebody on the street who's homeless, someone who's in a very vulnerable position, someone who's in a very sensitive place where they are right now in their life. Is Instagram or Facebook the right platform for that? I mean, there's a lot of questions surrounding that, that whether that's okay. But for me, to your question, Anne, it was a risk that I was willing to take to be able to say that through any of the great stories that have been told for change in any society, there's been a risk in doing so because you're always going to offend someone. I always consented with the person that was in front of me, and I'd say, hey, here's why I want to tell this story. I believe you're important, and you're telling me things that dispelled some of the myths that I had about this, and I think I can connect other people to this and inspire them. And when it's consented, I'll do so. But it's an interesting topic, and not one that I am fixed in any of my kind of beliefs in doing so. It's one that's interchangeable, but I actually look at social media and technology as a complete, I mean, it's as much a part of day-to-day as breathing. So it's, for me, it's just a vehicle for change as much as using our hands and mouth is in any other way. I've found it to be, in fact, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for Instagram. People help me from different communities and pick me up when I travel to do this in new cities, pick me up from airports, help me out. You know, the kind of stories I've been able to tell have resonated to people who I get, Instagram messages from all over the world, so I'm ever appreciative of it. But there has been some criticism here and there, but I think you're always going to get that from whatever you do. Thank you.
Hear me? Oh, okay. Maybe too much. So I know the title of the talk is Market Disruptors, and, you know, I don't really know a huge amount of that, but I think it's quite interesting. So how much, you know, obviously you've got a different way of, you know, doing quote-unquote charity, you know, different way of banking, you know, different way of looking at homelessness and, you know, those sorts of things in terms of your own stories. Really interesting to know how much of that is... Do you see that the new, the quote-unquote new ways of doing things, do you see that that is something which is going to be a trend? Is this something, is it part of a larger trend that you see going forward? Or do you see this as actually really pushing what is the quote-unquote status quo into a different direction, or maybe a mixture of the two? But I'm just thinking about how do your individual stories point to a larger idea about disruption, about a different way of doing things?
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, good question. The thing I was thinking of is sort of, as the three of us were talking and trying to think about how do you tie those together in some ways. And I think it comes back to technology. These two may disagree. I think for the first time, we're in a world where anyone can start a social movement on Instagram. And anyone can start an app that helps homeless people. And that's not a place we've been in before. And honestly, it's kind of weird and new. And there are lots of difficult questions to answer around that. And how do you think about the control that maybe we lose when we do that through Instagram? But over and over again, I think we'll see as we go forward how that enables everyone to disrupt, whether you're disrupting the market or disrupting the charitable sector. And being aware of that and being trying to be ahead of that for all of us, I think, is the way that we can think about that and take it forward.
For me, what's remarkable is the speed of things. So we just started in London and did that bit, but the internet is just utterly incredible in terms of acceleration. But also, of course, the whole world is sort of creaking in terms of institutions and things, because, you know, 10 years ago, if you want to do a startup, you've been and borrowed $5,000. Now you have to do a startup for about 50 quid, as you're saying. Suddenly, you know, the whole world is changing in terms of how we see a problem, how we can change a problem, and suddenly we're linking up in terms of knowledge around the world. So for me, the internet is a massively dynamic tool, and it can be and should be a tool for good, but more interesting, finance.
I think it's, yeah, thanks, is a really, really good question. For me, I think intent is everything. Your intention is everything, and it always will be. When I go to sleep at night, I have to know my reason why I do what I do. I have to know, not 100% all the time, but I have to know that I am doing what I'm doing for the right reason, and I believe in it. And I think that when that is your cornerstone of your belief and why you do what you do, for me, the rest is tools and ways of being able to do it and ways of being able to communicate those ideas. Like, for me, everything comes down to intention, because if you try and use a tool like social media and you're trying to you know, post something like Kind Acts for likes to try and just build your business off the back of looking good, like people can smell you out, and also you're not going to be able to live with it for too long. So I do what I do, speaking for myself. I know that I might come to a roadblock at some point, and maybe something bad will happen. Maybe I'll tell someone's story and it might come back and bite me. Maybe I'll get myself into a tricky situation. But I just know that life comes with risk. And as long as my intention is there and it's clear in my reason why, which I keep on asking myself, which is a very important thing, and I'm sure you guys must do the same, because nothing's absolute and you can't ever think it is, to truly kind of, you have to change with the tides. And I think for me, to your question of disruption, I think for me, honestly, I say this to not offend anybody in the room who's doing amazing things, because I don't know the answer, but I think it's the kind of set charity traditional format that really does need to change for me. I think helping someone needs a whole new articulation of what that can look like for you personally, like how you can use your ideas and skills to begin to connect you in your community to people who might need that, and in turn connect yourself. Because nobody told me how going out and doing the things that I do and meeting the people I meet would teach me and give me a nutrition that I didn't have in my life before. Primarily, I go out to help that person. But the byproduct of that is, damn, I've grown as a human more than I thought I could. And I don't think any of the charities necessarily articulate that. I don't think we kind of do that enough in schools. I go and I give talks in schools about all of these people, and I put up lots of visuals and different things that I take people through. But there's not nearly enough emphasis on why this should be a lifestyle, rather than someone really lovely, the way they put it in a question I had earlier in a talk, they said, I get it. This isn't just about a haircut. This isn't just about homelessness. This is about a lifestyle choice to try and be more present with one another and try and be available when you can. And I think it's that kind of education that I'm trying to disrupt, because donations are important and they keep things going. And I agree with every element of being able to donate when you have money and you have equity. But I don't have that. I don't have much of that. So I've got to give my time. We're taught in some ways that something like Maslow's pyramid of hierarchy is to build yourself and become in the best position you can as a human to gain equity, to then finally give. But I worry that that mountain then is too high to truly see what's beneath you and how you can directly help as you in your heart and your mind. Yeah.
Hi there. I'm a Monzo account holder, and this is a bit of an appeal for a both-and solution. I'm in a little market town in the middle of Worcestershire. We've lost all three banks, and it's a plea, really, for people to engage in financial inclusion, because I hear the relevance of technology. I use it, but I volunteer for a community transport system because we've lost all our public transport that takes lots of old people to lunch clubs and day centres and all the rest of it. They will never get there with Monzo. So it's an appeal to sort of, in some way, enfranchise people to go and work with in the day centres, in the village halls and all the rest of it. Because otherwise we're going to have a whole load of people just completely left behind. Comments, please.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So if you look at our customers today, the vast majority of them are 20 to 35, 40-year-olds. Most of them live in urban centres. Most of them are relatively well off. And that is not reflective of the wider population at all. That's something we're very aware of. I think the way we approach it is thinking about what are the things that we can solve today and then working our way through that. And so, for example, asylum seekers is something we know we can solve today. And then starting to think about what comes next after that. So we've recently launched a campaign called No Barriers to Banking. And it's to think about what are some of those barriers, some of those hidden barriers, like all of the bank branches in my town have closed, and working out how can we solve them through technology. It doesn't mean that everybody has to have the latest iPhone. And sometimes people, I think, make the mistake of thinking that the way we are today is the way that we're always going to be, and therefore something like Monzo is just not accessible to anyone without a smartphone. And instead, I think
the way we try and approach that is instead saying, we want to come to where people are. And so we started with a smartphone app because that's where the people that we wanted to start with are. But we're not going to be there forever. So we now have phone support so you can call up and talk to a real human being 24 hours a day. And I think that's the start of thinking about how do we start to make it more accessible for people and make sure that we're not just building something for anyone under the age of 70.
Hello. I just wanted to make a quick comment. So I actually met with one of my very close friends, but she lives in rural Herefordshire. Met with her between Christmas and New Year, and she confessed to me over a few beers that she was in a bit of a pickle with her money situation. She works hard, her husband works harder, but every month they had less than nothing, overdraft kind of thing. I suggested Monzo because another one of my friends had told me about it, and she kind of ummed and ahed about it and said, oh, I'll give it a thought, but I've got quite a chaotic lifestyle. I need to add it to my list. And I pushed her on it. I mean, she's a very intelligent girl, worked hard all her life. Eventually, she did it, and I saw her probably 3 weeks ago for a dog walk, and she said, thank you. So it's 8-9 months and she is out of that pickle. Not out of the woods, but she said just being able to see where her money was going, £2 here, £2 there, she's like, it's ridiculous. She's well educated. Do you think we need better education from a primary school level, not just on trigonometry or whatever, but on finances, mortgages, rent? Because not all of us are maths teachers, maths experts. I'm words, not numbers. And what do you think the solution is?
Thank you. It's lovely to hear that story. And I think part of what keeps us going is hearing those sort of stories. And something you said actually rang really true, where it's not about giving people fancy tools or a fancy smartphone app, frankly. It's about being able to see your money for the first time and take some of that stress away. Financial education today is dire, and we just see yearly generations after generations of people coming out of school and university with no idea at all. Martin Lewis of Money Saving Expert fame has been running ongoing campaigns of how do we bring financial education into the national curriculum, and I couldn't agree more that we need to do that, and we need to do it today.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, obviously, that's directly, speaking financially, but I think a lot rang true for me in what you're saying of how we educate people in so many ways. You know, it's actually baffling that it's not educated. It's baffling that you're not told about social scenarios that are as real as it gets, especially in impoverished areas, for instance, the UK. I mean, what the hell? Like, we should be teaching people. By the way, there's a thing called a loan shark. And by the way, they come and beat your door down and they will haggle you for every last penny, because when your debts aren't paid with certain companies, that's who they get to drive their profits, and that's how they get paid back. I mean, it's scary as fuck. That stuff is, if you're a kid, imagine getting a knock at a door and this strange man turns up who's usually built pretty well and suddenly he's in your house lifting out your TV. It's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, like, we need to be teaching these kind of things. And I just think, I look at that and I hear that question, and I hear the social kind of repercussions of not introducing that kind of education early, not introducing that to just go, by the way, like, we're education sector. And maybe, do you know what maybe it is? It's being able to separate a little bit back from the government to be able to go, like, we need to kind of, like, prepare you for that big world that's out there that sometimes does really try and shaft you. So I think it's a really important question. Thank you.
Community banking and things like building societies are in real trouble. And Facebook is launching Libra, a new global currency. What historical examples would you like to see kind of resurgences of? And do you think Libra is good for democracy and financial inclusion?
I think Facebook owning or controlling our currency is almost certainly a very, very bad idea, and something we should honestly fight to prevent as much as possible. Having said that, it's sort of based around this cryptocurrency, and broadly thinking about decentralizing currency and decentralizing money, I think is really, really important, because you start to take it out of the hands of the people that it's been in for tens and hundreds of years, and instead give individuals some control over that. And so whether that's Bitcoin, which may be better just for buying drugs on the dark web, or whatever comes next, I think that's what we need to look forward to for the future. And you can start to combine that. You mentioned community banking. You can start to combine those two together to think again about how do we give individuals control over their money and not leave them totally reliant on large-scale financial institutions, but also bring them together in ways that do help people. We see examples over and over again of community-based lending groups where people can borrow money from other people in their community in a really safe and fulfilling way. And the payback rates on that are unbelievable. Far, far better than you would ever get from a financial institution, far better than you would get from a loan shark, because you're doing it within that community. You're a combination of sort of peer pressure in some ways, there's sort of societal expectations, and people actually knowing you for the first time and being able to understand what's the right amount of money and what can you use it for. And so I think some combination of that for the future feels like a really, really great solution.
Hi there. I've got two questions. One is just sort of commenting on the juxtaposition of do something for nothing, and I'm assuming Monzo is a private company, profit-for-profit business, and that juxtaposition and, you know, the effect of the profit motive. And then second question, I work for a homeless charity, so really interested in the talk about disruption in the homelessness sector. And talking about the naivety, in a way, your response was a response to naivety. Naivety of just trying to help someone, and actually what can happen if you just try and help someone. But actually there's something so refreshing about the naivety of just helping someone, which is the sort of haircut thing, which is a beautiful expression of that. So I suppose, yeah, what first question around the profit motive and the second question around naivety in trying to help people.
Yeah, profit motive. So yeah, Monzo is a for-profit company, and I think it comes back to thinking about our theory of change and how do we cause that disruption. Honestly, building a bank is extremely expensive, and we think we can have the greatest good by building something at scale, because otherwise you end up just building, not just building. It's very easy to build a relatively small bank that suits a small proportion of the population. And we want to build something that works for millions or tens of millions of people. And today we've taken the decision that we believe the best way to do that is by building a for-profit company. But we're very aware of the disadvantages that come with that. And so one of the things we're exploring at the moment is something called a B Corp certification. And that basically takes your normal business structure where the main incentive is to create shareholder profit, and you need to prioritize that above almost everything else, and puts that on a pillar along with environmental and societal impact. And it forces the directors of the company and employees of the company making decisions to consider those all equally in every decision you make. And I think that, for us, is really attractive because it starts to combine what we see as some of the benefits of building a company, a for-profit company, but also hopefully avoiding some of the pitfalls that come with that.
Thank you for your question on naivety. I think that I just come from a background of running a soup kitchen, and I had a naivety towards that. And the first thing that we did was had three psychiatrists very kindly gave their time and volunteered there to help us
on a journey of learning how to work with people. The idea of Next Meal is about informed compassion. You know, you've seen a need, but what is the response? And again, of course, the internet's one of the great resources. And I think that all of us, you know, when we're confronted by a human need, we're all naive. That's part of our human, what should we do now? It can often happen, someone just falls over and collapses in the street. What should we do now? There was a sense of that. But I think that the more informed we are, and the great thing about the internet, it's readily available, and it can help. Certainly, if I just talk for myself selfishly, it's the first people that really love Next Meal are homeless people, because they were saying, look, we weren't really sure where all these places are, but suddenly we're aware, we can see. That's really good. It really helps in terms of the statutory services like the police, etc., that they've liked it. Hospitals like it because of discharge. People come in just because they're hungry, or people need to be discharged where they're going to eat next. Suddenly, Next Meal, they can do that. But more important than anything else, it isn't come to Greenbelt to say, I thought of something. It was to validate all your thoughts and to say, if this old chap in his shed in Muswell Hill could have done that, I really ought to do my idea, shouldn't I? And so I should think that's why I came and wanted to share that.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's an interesting juxtaposition. I think it's one that's definitely worth touching on. Like, I work with brands and businesses sometimes to continue and facilitate doing what I do. So even though Do Something for Nothing works very organically, there's been a couple of campaigns I've done, for instance, with people like Tom's, the shoes. These are a bit old now. But when you buy a pair of shoes off them, they give one away. They are a certified B Corp. So mentioned on B Corporations, I've worked with a few different companies and brands who have made that part of their ethos. Look, a business or a company as an entity, of course, doesn't have fundamentally part of its core compassion, because it doesn't exist. It doesn't have a heart and a mind, but the humans behind it do. Or they are, you know, they can. You know, and obviously sitting right next to you, it's very clear that there's people setting up businesses now thinking about the humans who are receiving this. And I think to be able to think of the end product and the consumer as a human, even in making money as a for-profit, is exactly what something like a B Corp does. And I think to touch on the naivety, I think it's important that we keep that in some ways as people, because if without that, you know, we're thinking things through too much. I often get asked, forgive me if anyone was at my talk earlier if I'm repeating this, but I get asked a lot, what's the best way to approach homeless people? And you want to laugh and see their face when I ask that to them. Mad, isn't it? Like the idea of asking someone, how should I best approach you? You'd be like, I want to punch you in the face. But like, you get what I'm saying. And I think what happens is people put a lot of barriers before a genuine interaction. Like, I still do it. I still catch myself doing it. I live in Peckham, South East London. I have to go through City of London each day. When I see people suited up and looking like they don't know that there's anyone in front of them, I'm pretty judgmental. I think sometimes those people look like reptilians to me, and I've got to be careful not to think that they're not. So I have to work on myself at the other end of the spectrum to think that, wow, we all look at each other a certain way each day. We're all thinking about the things we kind of, you know, I guess our own questions as to how we should approach a situation. I think with something like homelessness, we're asking so many questions of ourselves of, is this okay? Should I do this? Should I do that? And you end up in this pickle. I haven't said pickle for a while. You end up in this complete tangle in your mind of what you should do. And I think it's that naivety that should really come through and be like, look, I can still be in touch with my instincts, I can still have common sense, but I'm going to be naive enough, let's say, and call it that, is your question, to assume that this is another human and I am, and what's the worst that can happen? I like to call it curiosity as well, or being inquisitive, and I think we've got to keep that as people. One of the biggest things I find is that us and them is not created by that guy on the street. It really is not. So, you know, just to follow it back home, I think that, yeah, companies and brands and businesses, it's not inherent for them to have those human emotions we do, but the humans behind them, damn straight, they can be more diverse, they can be more inclusive, they can be more empathetic, and I think it takes people to really stand up behind that and make that part of their ethos.
One quick last thought on naivety, just as I was thinking. I wonder whether naivety is necessary almost to actually disrupt or to do a lot of the things that we see in Greenbelt this weekend. You hear stories of people, whether they're starting charities or campaigning against fracking, and I think if you took a step back and looked at what they were doing before they started it, it would seem impossible. And there's probably some element of naivety / curiosity that's necessary in order to do that.
Hi. I'm really interested in what you're talking about, Monzo being a tool for refugees or asylum seekers or homeless people to re-access society and services, or integrate into society, and also Next Meal as an incredible tool for people who are looking for to eat. And I'm interested in how you're actually engaging with those communities to so that they know about this service that you're providing, and whether if you are or if you do or are planning to actually work with those communities so that, yeah, they know.
Right.
If you go on to Next Meal, you'll see a blog. We write to the centres once a month. We sort of create a digital magazine where we suck in all this sort of information. But what we normally do is go to a city. So we just did Exeter, for instance. And do you want to hear an amusing story? Yeah. Okay. When you create things, if you're... I've never been called a disruptor apart from being at school, okay? But when you create things, people always say no, number one. And secondly, they're not interested. So we did a launch in Exeter, and I wrote to everybody to say, look, we've created this, you know, it's live in your city, let's come together and do a launch. And so we thought, where should we do this? We need somewhere big enough. Ah, the cathedral. Okay, cathedral do. They took a lot of persuasion, okay? We got the cathedral. And then, of course, no one's coming. You write to the city and there's no response. But then I had a piece of luck, and there's always a piece of luck. I wrote to someone who is the Lord Lieutenant of Devon, right? Now, the Queen has 12 of these people. I know you're big fans, okay? There's perhaps a Lord Lieutenant here somewhere. But okay, so I wrote to him and got an immediate response. I'm coming, he said. Remember, no one's coming. The cathedral are reticent, okay? So then I wrote back to all the people who said they're not coming, the chief executive of this, the head of the fire service, the police, and suddenly I said they're all lieutenants coming, it's confirmed, and they all came, the whole lot. But the one that was missing, you see, I got this garbled message. It's the Lord Lieutenant's office here from Exeter, and we're telling you he's not coming. That's 2 days before. I thought it was a very, very bad line. We still did it. There was no Lord Lieutenant. But because of him, we had a launch. We had the BBC. Blah, blah, blah. So, yes, we do go to the city. And what is the question of coming together? It's not to say, oh, somebody made a happy thing, you know, Next Meal, you know what it is. So the question is, when everybody comes together, and some of the role of Next Meal is you go to the city and say, what is your strategy to prevent street homelessness? Everybody's in the room. Everybody that is affected. The hospital's here, the police are here, everybody's here. What is the answer? Well, I think when does a person start to be vulnerable? And we could suggest about 3 years old, because many of the people who were finding on the street became street homeless from about 12. And so it's creating, we heard the question on education, resilience. That's what we should be shouting at educators. Resilience at a young age. And so, yes, we do have that role of coming together, going to a community and saying, you know what, it's not about centres. It's not about the people on the street. Yes, help them. But what have you got in place to increase that resilience in deprived areas, in deprived estates, and schools that are not doing well? That's where you should be putting loads of money, loads of resources, lots of care. And so that's a rather bizarre way of talking about homelessness, but it's talking about when it really, really starts.
when children aren't supported when they're very young.
Your question made me remember the time when we first built the ability to open bank accounts for refugees. And it was great. We were all very excited. And so we sort of posted it on our blog and sent out some emails and posted on Twitter. It was amazing. The whole week, all of our fans and all of our customers were writing in to congratulate us. And it was great. And a few weeks later, we looked at how many refugees had opened bank accounts. And the number was minuscule and hadn't changed at all in that time. And so we were just doing this sort of preaching to the converted of all of our relatively well-off young customers who thought it was great that we're doing something for refugees. And that was a moment for us where we realized we were going about things in the wrong way. And when we go out to build the product, when we go out to build that app for people, we go and talk to our customers. We ask them, what would you like to see in the app? What can't you do today? What's the financial education or the budgeting that you need in it? And then we weren't doing that on the side of things where we're thinking about how do we widen access to this? And so trying now to change that. So in two examples of that, I think, are now working out how do we take that financial education out into the community, working with organizations like Citizens UK to say, how do we go to where refugees and asylum seekers are and help them with the problems that they have? And that's not actually necessarily opening, they're not looking for an app-based bank today. They're working out, how do I deal with all of this financial system and how can we help to provide some of that support there? And then in the future, thinking about making sure that we're building things that those disadvantaged communities actually want. And so one of the ways we did that was talking to our customers and finding out that a significant proportion of them had gambling trouble and problems with gambling, and realizing that we could solve that with technology, provide you a switch in the app that means that you can't ever gamble, you can't spend on gambling websites, you can't spend in gambling shops. It took us about a day to build. Very, very easy, and we launched it. And now hundreds of thousands of people use that. And that was another moment for us of thinking about, okay, actually listening to our customers and the problems that they face is not something that we should just do in terms of building them a shiny app that they want, but also throughout that whole journey.
Amazing, man. Yeah, just to touch on that, I really appreciate both your answers and the question also. I think it's important to listen to the people who are already doing this stuff. So if you need to touch people who you want to make a change to people who are, you know, suffering or coming newly to the new case, you can see an asylum and you want them to benefit from your app, it's like important, isn't it, to tap into the people who are on the ground, speaking to those people, talking to them as part of that community anyway. And I think reaching out to those people who are already doing that work is important. Equally with any event where you're trying to get people together, I think it's just about trying to find, I guess, a cross-pollination where this comes back to really just losing that competition when it comes to these things, being able to like collaborate in a way that works for everyone. I've seen that like really well. I've been at some really interesting meetings of lots of people within the sector coming together and seeing how they can all help one another. I also think when you're trying to get a message out to anyone too, it's nice to try and sneak it in a different way than just the obvious way. Like you can put on an event and kind of talk about it there. You can put on an art show. That's what I do sometimes now, whether people like are interested, people, the things that people are interested to coming to anyway, like things that are going to excite people. Sometimes people aren't ready to receive a certain message, so it's about trying to lay it in other ways. I just think that on the face of it, when you try and get people together to come and have a meeting about homelessness, no one really wants to go to that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, not really. It doesn't sound much fun, does it? Bloody hell. That's going to be grey and depressing. It's going to remind me all of the things I'm not doing. It's going to give me an interesting insight into loads of people with really sad lives right now. It's like some of this is about just like vamping it up and going, look, let's get together for this and get a load of people in a room and go, nah, by the way, this isn't a gig we're talking about. No, but you get what I'm saying. Trying to put this into creativity and in the ways that people want to digest this stuff anyway. Sometimes it's very neurological the way people switch off when they hear certain words, you know.
Hi guys, it's really exciting to hear the different ways you've
get out of my chair.
thought those chairs were foolproof, those things.
Yeah, so you can design a new chair for me. The ways you've disrupted your sectors has been really interesting, but I'm interested in the maybe some of the failures as well, because it looks like you're the three guys who've got it sorted, and maybe we could learn a bit from this. I'm sure we can. But when you're an entrepreneur, there's some difficult moments as well. How have you navigated those really tougher times and the failures, and what kept you going?
Great question. I may as well, shall I just quickly, as I've got the mic? For me, what I'm doing has been an up and down struggle. And actually what you said about entrepreneurship, even though I'm working with people and with humans, it's a trajectory that's up and down. And people, it's hard to get that across. You're right. When you end up on a panel, you're giving a talk about this. A lot of the time you're talking about this journey, that it was this gradual succession to exactly where you are now. But like an entrepreneur, of course, I'm sleeping on sofas, first of all, when I quit my job as a hairdresser. Then I thought I had a bit more cash because I started giving talks on this in certain places. But then you get knocked down again. But then also emotionally too as well, the roller coaster that you go on as part of that journey as well. It's up and down. I think to talk specifically about failures, to be really honest, it's mainly been fatigue in myself and failures that I feel like I've never lost belief in what I'm doing. But sometimes, like any job does, life knocks you down a bit. And it actually comes back to everything that I'm doing, which is then I need people around me. I need people around me who are mentors, people around me who can help me out, people who can be my ear and listen to and talk to. And I find that whether that's in helping people and, you know, a human connection, or whether that's, I'm sure, in building a business, it's like you've got to have people there around you when you've got those knocks to try and help pick you up. To try and hone it in a little bit, I suppose, just to finish up, like, I guess the naysayers I used to, when I started doing what I'm doing, maybe get the odd, oh, how's a haircut going to help? What are you doing? Like, that's not going to change the world. Or maybe, you know, using these tools like Instagram and Facebook, there's a lot of people there waiting to type something against what you're doing. And I think, thankfully, through some self-search and actual introspection, I was able to realize that those people are really important for me, because they keep me questioning my reason why. A few years ago, I might have got quite triggered by that, and they became personal failures, because then suddenly this story that I was telling, or this person that I saw, even though it was all about that moment, it kind of got knocked down by this one person. I used to really let that sit heavy on me, but yeah, thankfully, it's been a few years now since I've felt that way, and I think it's through realizing that every person who challenges you is, actually, it turns out, more important to your journey than someone sending you a love heart.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I think it's so easy to, Monzo's been going through 4 years, and to look back and say, we knew exactly what we were doing, and when it was started, to think about the vision that we had, and now we've got there, and it's been a huge success. And in fact, it's honestly failure after failure after failure with an occasional success. And I think about it as you're sort of in this hall and you're pushing on doors, and there's 10 doors and 9 of them are locked, and you're just pushing enough that you find the one door that's unlocked, and then that's the door you just push on and push on and push on and push on, and you get everyone behind you to push on that, and just continually do that, and you just do that over and over again. One of the things we've done for our funding model is to launch crowdfunding and involve our customers and let them buy a part of the company. And we recently invited them all to come for a sort of quasi AGM, and we had 1,000 of them come to our offices, and we did a bunch of talks about all of our successes. And then one of the talks I gave was around all of the different failures that we've done. I filled half an hour just showing slides after slide after slide of muck-ups. And, you know, it's everything from things that seem small as I talk about them now, but when you're small business just starting out and you have 20,000 customers, and one day you accidentally email them all with just an empty email, it feels like the world's going to end, all the way to some much, much bigger mistakes that maybe I'll talk about for anyone who wants to after this. I think it's just constantly having that goal, like sort of that vision of we know where we want to get to, and feeling at least over a period of months or 2 months or 3 months that we are taking eventually 2 steps forward and 1 back, even if though many times it feels like 10 back and 1 forward.
Do you know what failure is? on the 17th of October, there's going to be a launch of next bill in the Houses of Parliament. A failure because there could be an election and Parliament will be closed. A failure because no one will turn up, okay? A failure because people are not interested because it's Brexit and, you know. And every time you do an event, it can be absolutely awful. Or it could work. And I suppose it's the life of that we would sort of feed on, is it's going to be a stonking, unbelievable success. Or there'll be stones thrown at me, shame on you, to get the terrace. And no one showed. Imagine that. And that's what it's like, isn't it? You just have no idea about what's going to happen. And so you live with that. And I think when it is wrong and goes wrong, it just keeps you, you know, feet on the ground and enables you to relate to the people you're relating to. I'm relating to people whose lives have gone very wrong. And next meal is okay for some and just a stupid idea to other people. And that's what life is. And have a look out on the 17th of October, okay? And feel for me when no one shows, all right?
Dear, I think that's great. I think we have 5 minutes left. I'd just say just quickly, just some really good advice for everyone, what taught me to learn, not necessarily about failure, but join a punk band, right? Like I used to be in, and when like 10 people turn up, you're so happy when just one person buys the CD. You know what I mean? When you just get just enough petrol to drive to the next gig, that really teaches you a very nice resilience and kind of an appreciation of just the audience of one. And honestly, that kind of comes down to, I guess, really why I do everything I do, is that honestly, to be honest, that's how I'm trying to transition my successes and my failures. It's about one person who's in front of me right now, and maybe it's the same similarly when you bring it down to one person who is your customer eventually who's using this app. It's like you... obviously, you know, in a macro sense, you judge it by so many, but really it's just like, how can you just make it better for that one person? And that seems to be a nice way to kind of make it bite-sized and digestible in a way that doesn't hurt so much.
Yeah, just a quick question about next meal. Sorry, I'm here.
Oh, sorry.
it sounds great, and I love the idea. I work in the homelessness sector as well, so I love the idea of having like a one-stop shop for homelessness services for everyone, which I think is what you're saying you do. But do you have a process for checking who's going on your app? Like,
yeah.
The organisations in the cities, how do you find them and update it, and do you check them out
first? I'll be very brief. We write to the centres every 2 weeks to a month that they're written to by us to make sure the data is correct. So there's a team of people just checking data. It's constantly checked. So that's the very heart of the thing. Is it accurate? So that's what a team of volunteers do, by emailing, phoning, making sure the data is correct. The great thing about everybody, those homeless centres is, and soup kitchens and things, they never change time. Whatever happens, you know, we do it at 7 o'clock on a Monday. So that's it. So that helps us, but the checking is right, the digital magazine's right, and constantly communicating is very important. Yeah, that's right. It's all about the data. Thank you.
So anyone who's got one more quick question, or maybe I'll just round it up, is that what you... it's going to be a very personal... it's not a plug for me, this. It's just, I guess, something that I'm always aware that when I talk about what I'm talking about, I maybe don't leave people with enough take-home as to how this can be maybe applied. Maybe to address the elephant in the room when we're talking about homelessness, there's a couple of people here who work predominantly in that sector, if you will call it, or it sounds like yourself, and maybe there's more people who have dealings with this. I think some things I've been discussing a lot with myself and people who are close to me is that realizing this stuff is a challenge, but when it works and you see these transitions in people, it's one of the best rewards you're going to get. And I think we're in a festival right now where I think the words love, compassion, empathy, and forgiveness are going to be spoken 50 times more by the end of the evening. And my question is, are those real, those 4, 5, however many words, unless we extend them to their fullest reach that they can? because you're going to hit a few barriers along the way, especially when we're talking about homelessness. You're going to hit drugs. You're going to talk, let's talk heroin, crack. Let's talk the really hard drugs. You're going to meet people who are annoying and might even look like they don't want your help. They're not great for it. They'd prefer your money and they'd prefer to spend it on more drugs. But we've got to ask ourselves, listen, there's a timeline to everybody. And where do you want to actually hit someone's story? It's not always easy, this stuff. You're going to see all kinds of issues of abuse and many other things. You're also going to see people who've fallen from grace. But I'd like to take all those words that are going to be spoken about many times and just realize that we've got to stretch them out a little bit further if we don't want to just be here this time next year and think, well, it's really nice to walk around and hear these messages. I think to live them, we need to stretch them a bit further. I'm not talking as an expert in this. I'm talking about someone who, I suppose, I want that for myself. I need it for myself too when I'm down. I need people to love me when I'm at my worst. But let's not end on a really deep note like that. Thanks for coming. And I don't know, whether anyone wants to kind of finish up, do you want to say anything, mate? Cool. Well, yeah, thanks so much for turning up, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.